Well, what has been happening since I've been gone? Dude, who stole my church? What is... Hey, if you're newer to Crossroads, hey, my name is Brian Tomo, what's known as a senior pastor around here. I've been out for about 8 weeks. Thank you very much for giving me the freedom to do that. Thank you, everybody. So honored to be a part of you. Really, really good. Before I get going on anything else today, let me just address the elephant in the room. My hair. I don't know why you people are so fixated on my hair. More people talked about it and emailed. How long is his hair? Okay, so here's the story. I haven't had long hair forever and ever. I just wanted to see what it was like. So I took a few months to do it, and I don't like it. Don't like it at all. But since I had all that hair, now I'm going, let's start trimming it back and just do some fun stuff with it. So that's where I am right now. I may come in next week with a little sumu ponytail up top of my head. We'll see what happens. I don't know. I'm just having fun. And today I'm going to have some fun too because, as I preach, because I want to give you some stuff I think is going to really, really help you. And some bells are going to go off. And your life is going to get better, and you're going to understand God better. I think that's going to happen. So let's pray before I dig into it. God, I thank you for the ability to do things that we wouldn't normally do, which is come to a dark room and hear and be pushed. I thank you, God, that you've brought me back to this dark room and these great people. I thank you that you've been putting something on my heart, and I ask that it gets out in the ears and in the minds and in the hearts of those who you brought here today. Help me to be clear and helpful and, most importantly, accurate. And I pray these things according to the character and identity of Jesus. Amen. The church I worked at in Pittsburgh before I moved to Cincinnati to help start Crossroads was a smaller church, 400. That's a pretty big-sized church, but for what many of us may be used to, a little on the smaller side. And we started having a little bit of a financial crisis because the toilets weren't flushing and things were not running in terms of water was concerned. And the reason was because we were on a well and the well wasn't pumping out the same amount of water. And so we got I was on the board because I went to seminary, was associate pastor, all that stuff. So I was on the elder board, even though I wasn't elding at all. I was very young. And so everyone's stressing out because we've got to tap into city water and we don't have the money to do that. Here's how much it's going to cost to do that. And it was a whole thing. And then one guy on the board just said something really profound. He said, well, if the well's dry, let's just dig another well. And everyone around the table went, yeah, we got enough property here. Let's just dig another well. Problem solved. This is a physical reality of what's happening with many of us. Our well is dry. There's no moisture in there. And we're sucking wind. The pump is running. We're doing what we think we need to do to get some moisture, but it's not happening. So we keep doing the same thing we're doing, trying really, really harder. And yet our soul is as parched as ever. And what I want to encourage us to do is, hey, let's dig another well. Let's try something different where there might be some moisture and where you might actually find the presence of God. And one of the ways that we are sucking air where it's not going to give us life is what I'm calling comparisonitis. It's competing with other people and comparing ourselves with other people. And we have an endless opportunity to do that because we endlessly bump up with other people, and we feel like I'm not stacking up to them, I'm a loser, or we feel like you're not stacking up to me, I'm a winner, or we feel like we're getting behind or we're getting ahead and our pride gets there, and we just have this exhausting inner conversation of, should I be doing more? How come I don't have that? Should I be doing something different? How are they doing something I can't do? Why do they have something I don't have? Why can't they figure out what I have? Why can't they figure out how to make life work like I apparently have, at least compared to them? And there's this ongoing competition that we have with everybody around us. And competition can actually be a good thing. It can be a really good thing. Competition is really good in youth sports. It's really good because it teaches kids, not everybody wins. And not only that, the way you win in life is you prepare for life. You do the dirty things before the game. You work out. You listen to your coach. And that's how you get ahead in life. You win life by doing things other people don't want to do and work hard. Competition in youth sports is really, really good. Competition in the business place is probably really, really good because people want to make more money. Business want to make more money. And so what do you have to do? You have to have the right talent. And have the right talent, you gotta pay more to have the right talent. So probably everyone's game gets elevated a little bit because you wanna be included on that team and you wanna be worth it and you wanna get more resources, and businesses is incentivized to pay larger amounts of money because a business wants to win. It isn't bad. In nonprofit world, 501c3, there's sometimes competition is really good because there's so many grant dollars that are out there, and I want to make sure our organization is going as well as it can so that someone's going to write us the grant. In medicine, competition can be good because you want the grant to come and fund your research so you can have a competition fight against cancer to do all these. So in all these areas, competition is actually good and it can be healthy. But where it is never healthy is when we compete with another person and they don't even know the competition is happening. Actually, they do because they're doing the same thing. This is a normal thing. Now, this is not a modern American problem. This is a human problem. This is the way we all are. And this is actually the way the earliest disciples of Jesus were. They were competing with each other. They were measuring each other up according to their own standard of themselves. We have James and John, brothers, come to Jesus, and actually their mom comes as well and says, hey, I want my boys to sit on your right and your left hand whenever you get into heaven. And the rest of the disciples are watching this going, what? Who says they get those spots? They're kind of upset that their mom isn't fighting for them. They're like, all of a sudden, the competition's on. Well, why do they get those spots? In fact, there was a little tension, ongoing tension within the 12 original disciples because Jesus gave special and preferential treatment to Peter, James, and John. He gave them opportunities that the others didn't have. He took them places the other people didn't go to. He says things that he doesn't say to other people. They go to a place called, well, it's up in a mountain, and it's known as the Transfiguration, and it's a place where he takes them up, and the rest of the disciples, the other nine, are going, there they go again. Peter, James, and John. There they go. What do they have that we don't have? What's going on? And Jesus gets transfigured in front of them. He sheds, if you will, his humanness, and they see his heavenly glory, his holiness, and he glows, and they're utterly freaked out. But these three have that, and the other don't. And inside of that, we have Peter and John. Inside of that clique of three, they still compete with each other. They're comparing each other. And by the way, as I'm talking about this stuff, this is never seen as good. It's never seen as healthy. It's just what it is. It's where we are. In John chapter 21, let's look at that right now. John, written by the book of John. John and Peter apparently are always competing. And in the resurrection account, I talked about during the last Easter that we had, John goes to great pains to detail, for whatever reason, that he runs faster than Peter. So we went to the tomb, and the one who Jesus loved got there first. That was him. And then we went back to the disciples, us, and then I got there first. I'd be like, what does that add to the story? What it adds to the story is you and I can see, like, oh, even the disciples who were close to Jesus, they had issues. And so when I have an issue, I shouldn't feel like I'm disqualified because those guys had issues. And one of their issues was competition with each other. Well, check this out. Here it goes. John 20, verse 21 and following. 21, 20 following. It says this. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. The disciple whom Jesus loved. What am I reading from? I'm reading from the book of John. How's John describing himself? The one that Jesus loved, by the way. But right here, Peter's around. I'm going to tell you, Peter, just a minute, tell you, I'm the one that Jesus loved. Love that. And then the one whom Jesus loved leaned back against him during the supper and had said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? And when Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? So Peter's getting maybe a little jealous. He's competing a bit with John. John is teasing on. He's like close to Jesus. He's leaning back up against his chest. They're having kind of a bromance moment there. He's talking to him, and Peter's he's feeling left out. He says, hey, he says, what about this man? What God, what are you doing with him? Jesus, what are you doing with him? Jesus said to him, if it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. So the saying spread abroad amongst the brothers that the disciple was not to die, yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die. He said, if it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Of the 12 original disciples, only one of them dies of natural causes of old age. That's John, who we're talking about right here, dies at the island of Patmos. One day I want to get there. It's one of the places I like to get to I haven't been to. He's the only one. All the rest of them, Judas committed suicide, and all the rest of them, they were tortured and killed for their faith. John's the only one who dies of natural causes. Was Jesus giving a little hint there when he says this? Maybe. But what he's saying is this, Peter, you're looking at what the relationship I have with John right now and how he's close to me, and you're worried about who's going to live longer? If I want him to live forever, what is that to you? This, my friends, sear this into your memory. This will serve you very well for the rest of your life. Witty. Witty. What is that to you? Jesus gets witty with him. What is that to you? Jesus says, I'm doing things in his life, and if I'm going to do this in his life, he's going to live forever. What is that to you? What's that matter to you? And at the same time, you'd say something like that to John. He'd say, John, if I'm going to have Peter be the rock of the church, if I'm going to have him do it, what is that to you? And God would say that to all of us. So we look at other people we're competing with who are getting ahead of us in business, who are getting ahead of us in our families, who have bodies that are better than ours, who have opportunities that are better than ours, who have parents that are better than ours, who have personalities that are better than ours, who have health that are better than ours. And we're going, why not me? Why? God would say to us, hey, if I'm doing this in that person's life, what is that to you? That has nothing to do with you. That has to do with them and God, not you and them, them and God. We have this thing that we're sucked in, this dehydration vortex in our culture where everything has to be Pharisees and everybody should have the same, and I need, or actually not the same, I just need to be a little bit better than you. Now, I need to feel like I'm better than you, and I need to be honorable, and I need to be humble, at least looking like I'm humble, and I need to kind of be going, and I use you as a barometer as to whether or not I'm doing well in life. And if you tell me I'm doing well in life because you're not doing as well as me, then I feel good about myself. If you tell me I'm not doing well in life because you're doing better than me, whatever arbitrary thing we have that makes us feel like I'm competing with you, then we go down. And no matter whether we're winning or losing in individual competition, our spiritual vitality is being sucked dry. We're in a hydration vortex. We're doing things that will never bring us life. We're looking for moisture and mental gymnastics that will never get us there. And this is normal. It's called social comparison theory, SCT. At least that's what it was coined in the 40s when someone identified this. Here's what it says. Social comparison theory proposes that there is a primitive drive within individuals to compare themselves with others in order to evaluate their own opinions and abilities. It's a primitive drive. It's primal. It's in us for whatever reason. But just because it's primitive and it's primal doesn't mean that it's healthy. It's a primitive drive to consume as many calories as you can. I don't know if you know that. It is. Anthropologists would say it's back when we were all literal hunters and gatherers, and you don't know when you're going to be able to kill something or pick something again. So when you can eat, you need to stuff and jam calories in you now because you don't know if you're going to be able to tomorrow or till next week. And that's why it's hard for us to push the fork away, because like it's primitive. Like I can get calories, I have to get calories. So just because it's primitive though, doesn't mean it's healthy for us, right? It's primitive for us when we're sexually attracted to somebody to have sex with them. I'm gonna talk about that next week. Just because that's primal for us doesn't mean that it's healthy for us. But just because we know we can and we're in this competition, if you want to be on a spiritual development track where you're getting moisture from God, where you're connecting with Him, He's filling us with His hydration, with His Spirit, we have to stop sucking air out of a well that never gives life. What is that to you? Who God has made somebody else to be? What is that to you? What God's doing in somebody else's life? It's not good. And maybe primal or primitive to judge people who don't look like us. Anthropologists would say that, yeah, back when everyone would normally kill each other because they were of a different tribe, you needed to identify physiological differences so you knew you were safe. So maybe it's primal that we don't trust people inherently of a different skin tone. Maybe it's primal that we don't trust people inherently who just look different than us. But that doesn't mean it's healthy. That doesn't mean it's right. We have to break out of these habits that we have because they don't bring life to us. So a number of things are, number one, comparison drains our relationships. The people who are frequently the loneliest and have the fewest friends are that way because they've sucked the life out of relationships because no one wants to be a friend with someone you're competing with. And we oftentimes smell that. We sniff that out. It drains our relationships. There's the Ten Commandments, which I'm sure you know of. And in the Ten Commandments, they start off with just between us and God, vertical commands, us and God. And then as you go through the commands, like around command 4, it starts going horizontal to our relationships with one another. The very first command says this, or actually says, you shall not have no other gods before the Lord your God. By the time it gets down to 10, Exodus 20:17, here's what it says. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his PlayStation or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. I don't even know what is it. PS3 at this point? What is it? 5. Gosh, all right, 5. PlayStation's not even that's still the best one. It was back when I was gaming about 80 years ago. Yeah, okay, all right. Anyway, lists a bunch of things. Hey, don't covet it. Don't covet it. And then Jesus comes along and he adds to it. Here's what he says in Luke 12:15. And he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. All covetousness. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. All, emphasize all. Coveting isn't about just physical things like a car, a spouse, a house. You can covet somebody's knack with numbers, all things. You can covet the family somebody has. You can covet the physical health that somebody has. You can covet the personality that somebody else has. You can covet, yes, you can actually covet the kids somebody else has and wish you had them as kids instead. There's all kinds of things that you can covet. And Jesus says, don't do it. Because when we do, we're telling God, what you've given me isn't good enough. And God says to us, what is that to you? How about just you and I, our relationship? Why do you have to constantly bring in what somebody else has or doesn't have? When I talk about healing, I've had a number of miraculous healing situations I've been a part of. It's really been, you know, odd. I didn't for a long, long time. And then as time went on, I've just had a number of them in the last, I don't know, several years. And I've learned to be very careful about how I talk about healings when they've been happening, because it's very common, very, very common that there will be some people that can't celebrate the healing because they constantly now compare and say, well, what about me? Why haven't I had that miracle? Why haven't I had that healing? It's great. Libby's sitting with me today in church. It's awesome. I never know what service she's going to come to. It's great that she's with me today. And it just reminds me of So I was going to talk about, which was, you know, one of her healings that we had just years ago. I'm not going to go into a deep dive with it, but she had a stroke, and she couldn't talk, and she couldn't walk, and it was just really freaky, and miracles from a lot of people praying, and the right hospital at the right time, Good Samaritan, and all that stuff together. In the span of not being able to talk, not being able to walk, she was hours later climbing steps, and the next week playing tennis. And I call it a miracle, and many medical professionals have. So much so, they put her on the front of their magazine, the hospital magazine. She and I, we went in, and they were, they asked us to speak to all the staff, what we experienced at the hospital and all that stuff. And we're thankful to the hospital, thankful for all that they did and all the great, great people. And always very careful and to say, and this is how God used you and a miracle of God. And because of her stroke thing, whenever somebody has a stroke issue, they'll contact us, which is totally great. If you can get a hold of me and you have a stroke issue, I'd love to talk to you, I'd love to pray for you. Always, always honored to do that. And sometimes I can sense with some folks, our story just discourages because, like, well, you had that, but I'm still limping. Why did God do that for you, but I still can't talk well? And I don't know. And no one says that. I can just tell. And when I have actually talked on healings, I have had people say, well, you said that, but why didn't God do it? If God wanted to heal this person, what is that to you? I don't know. I don't know. It's good to ask the question, but I'm just saying, I'm trying to give us uppercuts and jabs, say, can you see this is everywhere with us? The amount of energy and the amount of love that we could give if we didn't have this constant comparisonitis going with somebody else would be really, really good. I spoke a number of times about where men are and how the suicide statistics and mental health, and men are lonely, but is it any different with women? Really, the statistics aren't as bad with women, but you tell me, I'm not a woman, don't plan on ever identifying as a woman, but you tell me, those of you ladies, that it's just as bad with women. And you tell me that women are around each other, but the competition with other women is very high, very fierce. Whose body parts are bigger and smaller where they shouldn't be, who's got this kind of guy, who's got that kind of guy, who's got this opportunity, who's got that opportunity. I've talked with women who feel guilty telling other people they're pregnant because they know other people who can't have children, so they don't want to say it, make them judge, make them feel bad, and then you have this. It's just another slice of the same problem. We keep sucking the air out of a well that will not give water. We have to put our energy elsewhere. Comparison drains our energy, gives us less creativity and less love to give God and give other people. I have a friend of mine, Jim Bergen. He has a pastor, really great church in Colorado. And for years and years, we've been doing that horse weekend, you know, where my friend Todd Pierce, the horse whisperer, comes in and we bring that horse up on stage and it's awesome and, you know, sand gets kicked everywhere. And I'm an evangelist generally for anything that I'm really excited about. So when I'm around other pastors of churches that have big stages and have a pretty good size, you know, room, I'm like, dude, you got to do this. You got to bring this guy in. People will cry. It's going to be great. Your people are going to love it. They're going to bring friends. It's going to bring life. And like no one, well, Jim, he did it. He came to our church, brought a bunch of his staff members. Last time we did it, they took notes. They went back and they replicated it. And they had like the highest weekend service that they had all year, higher than Easter and everything in the beginning of August. It was great. He was just like talking how great it was. And then I was following him because of that. And I went to his Instagram and he had this picture on his Instagram. And I saw this picture. And it reminded, oh, that's right. Jim has a great house in the mountains of Colorado, and he's got a farm with a horse on it. And I immediately went, that's awesome. Great for Jim. Now, why did I do it immediately? Because God has been grooming this out of me for years. I don't struggle with this the way I used to because I recognized I was getting nowhere. I needed to turn the corner. And it was so fun to see this little picture of him on his Instagram story and go, it's great for him, and truly celebrate him. The book of Romans chapter 12, 15 to 16 says this, rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep, live in harmony with one another, do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. never be wise in your own sight. When we're competing with somebody else, we're trying to be wise in our own sight. We're the judge and jury over not we're running life correctly versus you. And I found that it's very easy to mourn with those who mourn. It's easy to mourn and grieve with people who've lost a loved one, who've had a bad medical diagnosis, and it's great, and we should all mourn that. But is it as easy for us to rejoice with those who rejoice? Is it as easy when you hear about somebody getting a raise? You're as excited for them as you would be heartbroken if one of their children died? Can we rejoice when people get a new car that's better than ours? Can we rejoice when somebody has opportunities that we don't have? A lot of us can't. And that may be a source of our relational tension. Rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn, and you can do that when you stop competing with people. You can just appreciate that person for who God has made them to be. All of us have blessings in our life. All of us have curses in our life, or I would say thorns in our life. The Bible talks about thorns that'll never go away. I've got a thorn I've been dealing with for a long time now. I have a dislocated rib. Last summer, I went away for my break, and I took my son and sons-in-law. I said, I'm going to get back into golf. We went out, and we golfed 3 days out of five. And of course, you're going to golf. It has to be 18 holes. No nine holes. It's like kissing your sister. It doesn't get you anywhere. So we went out, and after that time, my rib got dislodged in my rib cage, and I've fought it all year, gone to the chiropractor, I haven't golfed all year, it's been really, really tough, and I thought, okay, it's good enough, let's go out and do it. I did two times over 5 days. Well, you know, it's out again. Am I done playing golf forever? Am I done? And I was pushing this table down earlier, and I felt it, and I could start to go, God, what's the deal? Really? I got a rib? I got to deal with this? I got, what? And I got sent pictures of family in our church whose daughters have screws in her spine and straight in her spine. And I go, man, I'm so glad I didn't get bitter about why my rib was out. But I was asking the question, because someone always has it worse, and you can always find them if you're looking for it, and you shouldn't look for it because we shouldn't be comparing ourselves with other people. But all of us can know things about our life we like and don't like, and somebody else has things they like and don't like. And here's the thing, it's been said before, I'll say it again. Staring at somebody else's grass doesn't make yours any greener. Staring at somebody else's grass doesn't make your lawn any more lush. Fixating on somebody else's regimen for how they're taking care of their grass doesn't make your lawn any more beautiful. In fact, yours not at all. So why look across the fence? Why see what somebody else is doing in their life? Why take it personally? Why have to draw a conclusion as to why they did this or they should have done that or something like that? It doesn't make sense. In Canada, they did a study a number of years ago. They could do this because of the way the postal system is organized. I don't want to get into all that, but they were able to track people who won the lottery, and they could see that when you won the lottery, everybody around them got a worse life. Here's what they say in the Washington Post. They found that a $1,000 increase in Canadian dollars in lottery prize money caused a 2.4% rise in bankruptcies among the immediate neighbors over the next 2 years. When I was in Pittsburgh, I did a lot of weddings. It was kind of my job at the church I was at. And I did a wedding for a guy who was in my student ministry. And he came from very humble means. His dad was a university cop, the University of Pittsburgh. And they hit the lottery, like for seven figures. And I saw this. It devastated. It destroyed that family. Not just because they weren't necessarily aware of how to handle that money, but I saw everybody around them and others just claw onto them and judge them and be bummed and expect this and that because the comparisonitis. It's a hypercharged form of that. When you find somebody who can accept you for who you are and doesn't have to compete with you and doesn't use you as a measuring stick for what their life could be and can celebrate your wins and mourn your losses and doesn't spend energy doing anything else other than loving you and cheering you on, you have found a friend. And you've found someone who's being like Jesus. And all of us have this temptation This temptation to find what we're good at in our lane and compare ourselves to others. So the big money people oftentimes, the big money people compare themselves to the small money people and feel superior because, you know, I'm smart enough that I did this and I worked hard enough. And many of the younger of the small money people look at the bigger money people and feel superior because they go, well, you must have cheated to get the top. You must have done this or whatever. The body beautiful people look at the soft body people and they feel many like, okay, well, if only you could be as disciplined as me. If only you would understand this, if only you understand that. And the multiple degrees people look at the no degrees people thinking they're more intelligent because they have all these degrees and all this. Doesn't mean you can navigate life any better, because you have a lot of degrees and you can feel sometimes that you're intellectually superior because you have your degrees. And the family-centric people can look at people who don't have kids and can feel like you're, you know, what are you doing? You're doing judge. And the kids and people who don't have kids and read the Bible can see that Paul says it's great if you're not married. You can look at them and go, well, why are you married? Why would you waste your time with all those fights and all those things like that? And it's just, again, I go on and on examples of all the wasted energy that's happening. And what it does, it drains our focus. Drains our focus. Focus on what? Focus on Jesus, if you're into that sort of thing. Most of us aren't into that sort of thing. We want just enough Jesus to qualify us to check Christian on the hospital check-in form. We want just enough Jesus to be able to align with the political party that makes us feel ill. We want just enough Jesus to give us fire insurance if there actually is a hell. We want just enough Jesus to fit into the cultural context that we're in. Just enough Jesus to not upset mom or not upset grandma. Just enough. But man, when it gets tough, when it gets rough, when we're comparing ourselves to other people, for all of us who want to focus on Jesus, we cannot focus on Jesus because we're focusing on other people. What do you want to focus on? Want to focus on other people who are mere mortals, or do you want to focus on Jesus? I did some research for this talk, and I just went to Spotify, and I put in, like, comparison. Had some podcasts pop up and just started listing some. Here's a quote from one of them. Your focus always needs to be on your blessings, on your growth, on your goals, on your happiness, on your everyday movement. And when you compare yourself to other people, you're being a disservice to your soul. You got to start romanticizing your life. This is good. They're saying, hey, stop comparing other people. But what's the operative word in this quote? You're you. It's all about you. You're focused, your blessings, your growth, your goals, on you happiness, your everyday movement. Romanticize your life. I choose to not be about me. And anybody who come after Christ chooses the same thing. It's not about us. It's about focusing on Jesus. That is where the water is. That is where the spring of life is. That is where the well is. Just thinking about, not thinking about somebody else, but thinking about myself and myself and myself. I still have no water in and of myself. I have to go to the source of the water. I'm to compare myself to Jesus. I'm not to compare myself to my CEO friend. I'm not to compare myself to my body lifter friend, body weight friend. I'm not supposed to compare myself to I'm comparing myself to Jesus. He's to be my standard. He's to be who I want to be. This is what Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 says. Am I giving you too much? Is everyone okay? Are you gonna? I'm either boring you or I'm something you. You're either sitting like, I know that look. I have you busted. That's the look. That's the look. I understand it. It's been a huge thing in my life. Romans 12:1, here it says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, the witnesses here is not all the people we're competing who are around us. The context here is people who have focused on Christ and have gone to heaven and are aware of what's happening here right now. There's a cloud of witnesses of people who have chosen to follow Christ and are in heaven right now who are looking at you right now and cheering you on. That's what they're talking about. And let's lay aside every weight, every sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, focusing on Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Look to Jesus. Be focused on him. He's the founder and perfecter of your faith. You're not the founder of your faith because you figured it out, and therefore you're just smarter than the person who's still an atheist. No, no, no. He founded your faith somehow that you may not even be willing to acknowledge. He's the one who's perfecting your faith. Philippians 1:6 says, he who has started a good work in you will be faithful to complete it in the end. He's the founder and perfecter. So focusing on him, on his character, is the way to go. One of the things I'm grieving deeply is the Olympics are over. Wasn't that 2 weeks of entertainment heaven? Wasn't that just great? Like, man, I could come home. I can watch competition that's healthy. I can see the American soul. I can root for my country. I can see good sportsmanship. It's just mesmerizing, utterly mesmerizing. One of my favorite moments was when Sha'Carri Richardson was running her race. Now, in case you're not aware of this, or if you are aware of this, let me give you some background here. Sha'Carri Richardson, I watched a thing on Netflix several months ago on sprinters, and Sha'Carri Richardson is one of the greatest sprinters in American history, and they were expecting her, like months and months and months and months and months ago, to clean up the Olympics, and she did. She did really, really well, but she didn't do as well as people thought she would have done 2 years ago because she didn't qualify for as many events as everyone assumed that she would. So she comes into the Olympics. I think she's got probably got a little chip on her shoulder. She's bummed that she's only in a couple events. I think it's a gold medal in her first event. And then her last event, it's a 4x100 relay. So four runners are going 100 yards, and she's running the anchor position, and she gets the baton way in the back, and let's just watch this leg and watch what she does if you haven't seen it.
Comes Sha'Carri Richardson. Look to the far side. Sha'Carri's got him covered.
She looked over once. See you later.
Wow. That is gangster right there. You want to look at that? That is gangster. Let me tell you something. If you ride a bicycle or you ride a motorcycle, you know this truth. Where do you look? You might say, well, you look where you're going. No, you don't look where you're going. You go where you look. The two wheels are on two wheels. It's magically weird. Like where you look, the bike will go there. You go where you look. For her at that moment to look off to the side as to why she did this, she had some reason. She says, but when she looked off the side, when I saw that, I thought, oh no, this is horrible. This is horrible. Because if she's looking over there, she's going to go over there, and she's only got to go a few inches. She steps over the line and she's DQ'd. Now, fortunately, it worked out great. She's awesome, awesome, awesome. But here's the illustration. Here's the illustration, man. This is what Hebrews 12:1 tells us not to do spiritually. We're to focus on Jesus. We're to look at him. We're not to look at anybody else. Nobody else. We're not even to look at ourselves. We're supposed to look to him. He's the author and perfecter of faith. And the more time we spend looking around here, what do you have? I don't have. What are you doing? How's that? Or what about this? And before we're doing this, we can't go. We can't finish our race. There's a race for you to run. There's something for you to do. There's somebody for you to be. There's a life for you to fulfill. And guess what all that is? That's everything from here to Jesus, and he is the goal. He is the target. He's where we're going. And the sooner we let that sink into our blood and start drinking that water, the sooner our hearts are going to be nourished and fulfilled. I had a pretty horrible thing happen to me. I'll end with this. I had a pretty horrible thing happen to me. A few weeks before I left for my break, horrible. I overstayed a bit. It felt horrible to me. I was in my men's group. I've been in a men's group for a long, long time. And this group of guys I was with, and we were going around, and I don't know how it came up, but one of the guys in the group started talking about, we're at his level in corporate America, how much people make, the bonuses, the stock options. And he was talking about it in the context of people being stressed out and other stuff. And it was really good, really appropriate to do. Really glad he did. And it really messed me up for about 24 hours. because this guy's not, he's not in the C-suite. He's not like a CMO, chief marketing officer, or something like that. He's up there. He's not there. He's a bit younger than me, and he's talking with us, and I just thought, I didn't realize people made that much money. Wow. No, I'm very thankful. CrossFit is very generous to me. I make way more money than I ever thought I would make. Thank you. Thank you very much. And when I heard this, my old comparison kicked in. I was like, what? What? And I thought of the people who were at this person's level. And I thought, a lot of mine know I'm a brighter light bulb than them. And for about 24 hours, we're going like, what would my life look like if I put my energy elsewhere? What would it look like? And I started going down the dry well I hadn't been in for a long, long time. I got surprised by it. Like, I've done, okay, I've kicked this stuff. And then all of a sudden, like, I got back this, I found myself trying to suck water out of a dry well again. And then I sense God say to me, what's that to you? What is that to you? And I started reflecting. I started with God. I said, oh, God, that's right, that's right. When I was 15, 16 years old, I gave my life to you. Now, when I say I gave my life, I mean I gave him my life. I don't mean that's a word you say when you have a spiritual thing. No, I asked him into my life. I dedicated my life, and I gave him my life, and he gets to do whatever the heck he wants to do with my life because it's his life. It's not mine. It's his life, and I focus on him, on where I'm going, where I think he's taking me. I focus on him and whatever he's doing in other people's lane. What is that to me? I only get frustrated. I only get angry. I only get bitter when I start looking to the left and to the right because I gave him my life. Friends, be one of those who actually gives your life. Doesn't talk it, actually gives it. Actually does what you think Jesus is asking you to do because he's at the end of your lane saying, come on, come on, come on, this way. Psalm 143, 6, last verse. I stretch out my hands to you. My soul thirsts for you in a dry and parched land. Can't you see how dry and parched our land is? Can't you see the way that we live life doesn't work? Can't you see how dry we are? And because we're following the script of looking left and right and competing and contrasting and comparing. And if you want the moisture of Jesus, you have to reach, stretch out for the moisture. Stretch out. Let's do that right now. If you want it, stretch out right now. Try not to hit the person in front of you. Stretch it out. Stretch out. Come on, actually, let's stand up right now. We're going to sing a song. I'm going to pray for us with our arms out. God, look at these arms that are out. Arms are out because those who are reaching out, we're stretching out. We're saying, we want moisture. We don't want to be parched anymore. We don't want to be like the masses anymore. We want you. Would you fill us? We're stretching out to you straight in front of us because we're focusing on you. God, would you pour grace in these arms that are stretched out? Would you pour clarity? Would you pour peace? You are good and sorry, so sorry for looking left and right. What is that to me? It's nothing. But you are. You're good. Amen. see you next week.